Put those searchlights up on the tower. Right now. Move! Move!
I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.
Hello, I'm Herb and welcome to Community Spotlight. Every Friday, 10 o'clock, we shine the spotlight on one of our local members, and this is going to be part two of our spotlight to Ron Vicaris. Welcome, good morning, Ron. Well, thanks again for coming in for part two. We didn't cover everything we needed to last week.
I don't doubt it.
So, well, you've got a long year life so far, 99 this year, and next year on the 28th. Of June 2025, you'll be 100.
If I get there.
Oh, you'll get there. You'll get there. Born in 1925 in Eastwood, Sydney. So, I want to go back to a few points that we made last week and we didn't actually elaborate very much. Firstly, I want to talk about the Japanese subs in Sydney Harbour. Now, that occurred May, June 1942. What were you doing then in Eastwood, in Sydney?
I was a junior member of the ARP, as it's called, Air Raid Precautions. So I had an armband with ARP on it, and I had a tin hat, or a steel helmet, and a gas mask, and I rode a bicycle.
How old were you?
I worked then.
And you're working for the
Department of Road Transport and Tramways.
Oh, that was your first job with long trousers.
That's right.
Yeah. So, and what did you, well, how did you know that they'd entered the harbour?
Well, I didn't know at all, because we were called out, because there was an emergency, but we didn't know till the next day what had happened, because it was a real kerfuffle, you know. Manly ferries were still running while looking for the subs. This is early in the morning of the Sunday, yeah.
And they did find the subs in the...
Oh, yes. Well, they sank, three of them, or they sank themselves too. And one got away and was found only a few years ago, further north off the coast. There were four altogether.
And they were midget subs, and
yes,
you actually did see...
Two men
per sub?
It was a suicide mission.
Yes. And desperate times, desperate measures.
Mm.
You did see one of those subs later when it was retrieved?
Yeah, being lifted out of the harbour. That was on the Thursday. It was lifted out of the harbour and dumped down in the Botanic Gardens on the lawn in Farm Cove. So we had a look at this little submarine, and as I said to my mate, crikey, how can you fit two men in that?
It would have been a crowd gathered to see all that?
There wasn't then, but lately it was taken around Australia or some kind of money drive
for the war effort.
Yeah, yes. I didn't see it then because I was joined up myself, but 6 months later, yeah.
So let's just jump from that experience to the surrender of the Japanese Navy in Yokohama Harbour, Tokyo, Japan. You're on the HMAS Piri when Emperor Hirohito surrendered his military forces.
Yeah.
You saw that, and we talked about that last week, but then the HMAS Piri steamed to Hong Kong with a flotilla of Australian corvettes and British sloops.
Mm.
How many would there have been?
There was about 10 of us, I think.
Right.
This little flotilla, yeah.
Must have been a relief not having to look out for...
First time we could, without lights.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that last week.
Put our lights on, yeah.
And the important thing, you know, as we said last week, the important thing was not to have light while you're with a battle fleet.
Mm.
Because that would be a dead giveaway, just like your radio transmissions. That's why the signalman was very important in those days.
That's right, a visual signalman as it was.
Yep, so you could make silent communications with the rest of the fleet instead of giving your position away through radar
That's
communication.
Right.
Now, you did mention last week you became the unwitting agent of the Raj.
Yeah.
Now, tell me about that.
Well, first of all, I'll just mention something pertinent. We left Sydney on the 22nd of June and we arrived in Hong Kong on the 18th of September, and we'd been at sea all that time. So our first thought in Hong Kong was to get our foot on dry land. Anyway, that's just another side.
You would have had your you'd had sea legs. You would have been
that's
a bit wobbly.
Right, that's right. Well, when I found there were the way the Chinese people were treated, we for us, the scraps of our galley, our food, a little band of Chinese would come on and clean our domestics and do all our domestic washing and so on. This is the treatment of the Brits, of the coolies, as I call them.
But that would have probably supported a number of families.
Oh, I understand
or villages.
That, but at the same time, it didn't do, reckon with me, and it was just a little aside. We were young, 20-year-olds, innocent sort of blokes. You might think that's strange. But we used to have to hire a sampan to go ashore because we were anchored out in the bay. And so on this occasion, we got in the sampan, and who should be rowing us? Well, the women. We said, that's not... No, you blokes will draw us. Yeah, innocent Australian Democrats. So then we made the men row us ashore. We didn't think what would happen when we got out. When I got out, they probably got the rounds of the kitchen, as we used to say, afterwards. But the way they were treated, and most singularly, the big hotel there, that can't think of the name now, it was like Raffles in Singapore, where the Navy set up its headquarters, and all the gentry who'd been in internment camps came back and took over the colony, and they locked officers only. Now, I wasn't a drinker, it didn't affect me, but it affected me and the idea, officers only, these RN blokes have been on the Merman's convoys, and they've been through these battles here off Okinawa, and you won't allow them to go into your hotel. No thanks. Class system, Republican forever.
So
I don't know if that makes sense.
So the class system's very much an English system.
That's
in
right.
Australia, we don't have that same...
Oh, we do have it a little bit.
Oh, a little bit, but all, probably in those days, probably a lot more than we have today.
Yeah.
But definitely the class system in the English, well, particularly in the English Navy, in the English... how'd you become the unwitting agent?
Well, that was it. We were there to take back the colony for the Brits.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes.
I didn't learn that. I wrote a bit of verse about it years later, but I didn't think about it at the time. Mm.
Very much the class system, but also how the population in the Chinese...
Were treated.
Yeah. So, I want to jump away from your military service. You finished in 1946. You're out. And you trained as a teacher. You're married, a couple of kids.
Yeah.
Trained as a teacher. And you're starting your teaching career. But... war came back again in 1955 to 1975 as the Vietnam War. Now, your position from being in the military changed to anti-war. Tell me about some of those anti-war days.
Right. Well, it first occurred to me when I was teaching at Wagga Wagga Teachers College. That was in 1966, 67, and I... but what are we doing here? It was never declared. No war was ever declared for a start. That's how troops went over there. Anyway, I won't go on with that.
This is the Vietnam War where the Australian troops were involved in 1962 to 1973.
Yeah. And then conscription was brought in. And this is what the part that I was opposed to. What we call the marble lottery. Remember they're drawing the birth dates out of the barrel? And you'd be drafted. Now, I was against conscription. We'd never had conscription before, especially not in the First World War. They had two referenda. The Australian troops wouldn't have support conscription. So I was against it on two grounds. Politically, what are we doing over here in Vietnam? Nothing to do with us.
Somebody else's country.
That's right. And somebody else's war.
Yes.
So I was against that on two grounds because I knew... I had the suspicion, which was... I wrote a play about at the time about it, that the Americans were setting up bases here in Australia, and Northwest Cape, and what's the one in Central Australia?
Pine Gap.
No evidence of it. I just had a feeling, and I was verified that it was going on. That was their quid pro quo, as I call it, for going to Vietnam. Our troops, I mean.
So I don't think the sentiment's actually changed in all that time in that, you know, sending Australian troops to fight off in foreign wars for foreign powers seems to be the way of the world. And tell me, what demonstrations or what did you actually do during the Vietnam War to...
Well, when I moved to the Teachers College in Sydney, Paddington, I became part of the teachers against Vietnam moratorium. There was a smaller group, and I was treasurer of that, and I was part of the... I also belonged to the committee that was running the movement in Sydney. We used to go to meetings every couple of nights in the week. It was full of trade unions and religious people and so on. It was called the Vietnam Moratorium Movement. And so I was part of both as, I was teacher's representative on that committee, so I belonged to two committees.
So during the Vietnam War, do you remember, in that anti-war sentiment, do you remember any of the demonstrations you went to in Sydney?
Oh, yes, yeah.
What were they?
Well, one particularly was on the 8th of May, if I can remember the date, 8th of May 1970. We had a big demonstration in Sydney, and there was a big bill by the newspapers that we were going to take over the streets or some such nonsense, which was not, never our intention. However, when the day came, we sat till 3 o'clock in the morning of that day to try and convince the government that we were not revolutionaries. We were going to take over the streets as the Askin was a premier at the time. And we even sent a delegation up to Parliament House to try and get some kind of recognition of what our real intent. Anyway, the demo came and I was with the armband on as a marshal. So I'm directing it from in Wynyard Park in Sydney, and they were formed up there and went down and along George Street and through Martin Place and so on. What had happened, that moved off, but I stayed there because stragglers were coming in. Do you know that the police were on the railway station at Wynyard, at Town Hall and North Sydney, and anyone wearing an oratorium badge? That was illegal then. We were considered non-citizens. They were sent, stay on a train and get sent up, so they couldn't get out at Wynyard and join the demo. Anyway, that I was there, and I couldn't get back in to the demo because all the streets were blocked with paddy wagons. And so I walked along the street, I can't think, York Street, one of those streets on that side of Sydney, western side, and I went to step off the footpath, and the constable said to me, if you step off that footpath with that badge on, you'll end up in that paddy wagon. So what am I going to do? I'm a marshal. Am I going to abandon the blokes and sit in a paddy wagon? That's no, I decided, a better part of valour. I didn't step off the footpath, but I had to keep walking. I had to keep, I couldn't get back into the demonstration. So I was threatened with being arrested, in other words. And I spent the rest of the evening going around to all the police stations to find out who were there to bail them out. That was my experience of it. It was interesting, there's a couple of reasons there. One of the fellows was from Sydney University. He was a young man from the university. He was a bag man. He had his bail money. They were ready for these sort of things in those days. And he'd been a student of mine at Ballina High School. So I met somebody the evening, we didn't finish on a dull note. I went around these police stations getting the names of the people who were in. They weren't very cooperative, the police, shall we say. I wasn't just a mouth man. My son was coming up for conscription, turning 20, and I decided I would make the effort to serve his place. I got this thing from the post office in registration form, filled it in with a covering letter saying why I was going to... My son didn't have a vote. He had no say in our foreign policy. I wanted to take his place. It took me 3 months to get a reply, but said, you don't fit the qualification. You're too old. But I made the effort.
And he did. Did he get conscripted in the end?
No, he didn't.
His number didn't come up.
Yeah.
So I just want to get you to make a comment in that we know from the history that the returned servicemen from the Vietnam War were treated very poorly by some people in public.
That
so tell me about that.
In the country areas, really. Mm. In the city, yes, but it wasn't so the case here, for instance, because I've talked to fellows here up in Gora and places like that. They were treated very well.
So why would it be a city?
City was more. I can't claim to know, but one of my students at Ballina High School, a different one, he joined our movement and he served a year in Vietnam. I marched with him in a demonstration, the first return serviceman in a protest march. So I had a bit of involvement.
Yes, I think we've got to acknowledge on both sides the anti-war movement, but also those that were conscripted.
Oh yes, we had no objection to them. Mm. We weren't against them at all. They were.
It was the government sending our troops our own soldiers, our own population to a foreign country, to a foreign war, for a foreign power.
You know what our minister said about us? We're political bikies raping democracy. What sort of a status is that? I've carried that all the rest of my life.
But basically you were responding as a democratic member of our community, yes, and putting your points forward that you didn't want our young men and women to be in the Vietnam War.
That's right, yeah. The sentiment changed, as you know, after the war.
I think it took a long time for the Vietnam returned servicemen from the Vietnam War.
They suffered a long time.
But we thank them for doing that.
Because I know a lot of them.
Yeah. Well, there is, yes, you come across them from time to time. So, 73 was when Australian troops came back.
Oh, yes.
The people in the country aren't as hot-headed and as opinionated as those city
that's
folk.
That's right, yeah.
And they were treated pretty well in the country areas when they returned. Well, they were from families, you know. A lot of them were just from families, farm families, and back after being forced to go to another conflict.
Yeah.
So did you get into any other, after the Vietnam War, did you get any other anti-war type movements?
No, I read it. That was my last miserable protest. I wrote an essay about it, and I think I haven't protested since, in that sense.
So what was the play? You said you wrote a play about the Vietnam
Crossing,
War?
Yes, it was about that time. I wrote it when I was in Wagga. That was in 1966. And I entered it in a drama competition. And the judges took me aside and said we couldn't possibly play that here.
Is that
Wagga,
because it was too political?
Yeah.
Well, tell me what it was about.
Well, it was about three generations of Australians. First World War digger, Second World War digger, and a young conscript or possible conscript in the marble lottery at a crossing between Wagga Wagga and Junee, a railway crossing. And there was a phantom train not on the schedule coming through. And just keep warning about having to make special arrangements for this train coming through. And that, to me, was the American Pine Gap and Northwest Cape. I couldn't do it. I had to do it metaphorically. And these three fellas have all been damaged by their services, their war service. The first two men, old, and the young man, he eventually gets run down by that train.
Well, it's very poignant.
Anyway, that was my view then in 1966.
And have you changed your view since?
No.
Still the same?
Yeah. That play was first performed on the stage at the University of New England in 1973. Crossing, I mean. Mm-hmm. So it has a local.
So maybe we should get it back and do it again just to remind people.
It's been done a couple of times in other places, but never here.
I think our population needs reminding that we shouldn't be sending our men and women to fight off foreign shores for foreign powers.
Mm.
I think there's a point there, particularly that we live in a very strongly democratic society.
Mm.
Well, anything else you'd like to add? We talked about your teaching and your lecturing last time. Anything else you'd like to add? I think we've pretty well done a fair bit.
Well, I've given the impression I've done a bit of writing and playing.
You've done a bit of writing, yes.
As well as performing.
40, I think you said, didn't you? 40 or performed?
Performed, didn't you?
And numerous stories and books. You had a number of books here last week.
That's right, yeah. The Armidale context, I got played in the film, The Chanter of
Jimmy
Blacksmith. I played the judge.
That's right, yes.
And just recently, an Aboriginal woman, Kerry Mason, approached me with a photograph of me as a judge. She's an Aboriginal woman from here, and she was part of it too, in the mob scene out to the west. And I'm in the courthouse here playing. 50 years later, I find somebody who was in the same thing.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
It's only 6 months' time before your birthday,
yeah.
28th of June. We'll have to have a street festival for your 100th birthday.
Yeah, all right.
We'll put something on. Maybe we can do something here at 2ARM for your birthday. Bring you in and wish you happy birthday.
All right.
Do something like that. Well, thanks very much, Ron, for coming in. It's been another great bit of a chat with you. And I hope you have a great Christmas.
Thank you. And you, who are ARM FM listeners.
Yes, yes. And this will be a podcast. Well, thanks, Ron. That's Community Spotlight, and we've had Ron Vicaris in for part two. You're one of our community members. You're one of our gems in our community, and I thank you for coming in.
Broadcast, then podcast. If you missed it or want to hear it again, then visit our webpage, 2arm.net.au/podcast. I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.